You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm Hillary Plattner, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Hillary Plattner. She's the author of The Mama Puzzle, a memoir. Hillary, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good, Tony. Thanks for having me. I've been telling friends that I'm going to be on a podcast, and I say I'm feeling nervo-cited. It's not a real word. It's like nervous and excited together, and also a little vomitatious, which is also not a real word. I'm honestly good.
But do you have something where that feeling kind of is a place of like action too, where you're feeling that stirring, and maybe the stirring is because there, like, it is nervous excitement, but there's kind of a beauty to have that nervous excitement in situations that are fun when you're promoting your book.
Absolutely. Yep.
I was talking to a friend the other day, and they were telling me about, we were all talking about what we do before book signings and before doing panel discussions and stuff, before we're in front of an audience. And I mean, I used to take like 3 shots of Jameson, and then I'd have like a half a cigarette off of someone, and then I'd be like, okay, I'm a little steady. And then like these days, I don't want that at all. I want that vulnerability bubble in my gut. Because it just feels like that's so much truth. And even if I do feel like I'm going to throw up, if I throw up, there's no problem with it. I'll throw up. I'll just go to the side and throw up. And it'll be probably more memorable than if I had a couple of shots.
That's right. Well, I don't know what to say about it. This is my first book that's being published.
Yeah.
I've published smaller things, you know, poems and stories, but it's my first book. And I do feel like this, I'm excited to be on the ride with this book. Like, I did the work of getting it done, and now I want to just put my little pony out there and let her run and see how far she can go and where she'll take me, you know? And I'm excited to be on this ride. You know, and it's a period of, I think, a great personal transformation that I'm undergoing.
Yeah. That
getting the book published has been completely positive.
Yeah.
And so new, you know. I mean, one thing that's happening is that I've, in spite of having a lot to do to publicize the book, which comes out, you know, as of when we're recording this next Tuesday, June 2nd, The Mama Puzzle with Apprentice House Press, which is a really wonderful organization too. We end up talking about it later. But so I've been also writing a lot. Like, suddenly my writing self is waking me up at night. It's like the faucet is on and the stars are aligned, and I am kind of writing almost nonstop the last few nights. It's been hard to sleep. I'm writing a long poem that's kind of trying to figure out if it's a rap or a sonnet, like a series of sonnets. I'm calling it a rap net or like a rat's nest.
Yeah.
Something else too has started coming to me. So, and the other thing that's been happening is that when I go out into the world and I share what my book is about, which is new for me to be able to talk this much and this openly about suicide, which I was really taught in my family to, you know, not talk about from early on. And I really had to go against that to write the book. So now I have to say, people, I say, I'm having a book come out, and people say, oh, what's it about? And I have to say, it's about my mom. And then, you know, she committed suicide. And then sometimes they still look pretty shocked and unhappy. And I have to learn to talk about that in a way where I'm not back there feeling ashamed of it, you know?
That, yeah.
And also,
Oh, go ahead.
yeah.
Go
And
ahead.
also, when I have shared stories with people who are a lot younger than me and don't carry so much of that stigma and prejudice against suicide anymore, because I think it is something that's really changing currently in the world, and what people think and understand about suicide. There's a lot that I've been thinking about and could say about that. This book becomes my calling card, and people, especially in that age group, I don't like to cite statistics too much because they're just numbers and blah blah blah, but
Yeah. But
suicide is,
they actually give us a little bit of grounding of what's going on. So.
yeah, they give you a glimpse of reality, and one of them is, and I'm going to try to not get it wrong, but that suicide is the globally the third or fourth leading cause of death of young people ages 15 to 29.
Yeah.
And that is huge, you know? It's like what that says about the world.
Yeah.
So I meet those people, and it's only happened a few times so far, but I think it will probably keep happening. Then they just immediately, I'm open, and then they share their story, what happened to them. And they almost always have a story, and it's very personal, and we just immediately have this way of connecting across this place that hasn't been talked about that much. And so it's like a part of an opening up,
And it's
you know?
re yeah, it's really I really it drives me crazy how much it's not talked about, even to the point where you can't even say the word on like certain social media platforms. And I'm like, why are they demonizing this word? Because this word is actually very important to the human condition right now. And we need to be the more we're open about it, the more we can talk about it, the more we can go, hey, you feel like you're at your very last. A lot of us have been there, and guess what? There's more you can do. You feel free to go to a hospital. Guess what? A lot of us have. That when I told people that I checked myself in for suicidal ideation because I was at the this was about 14 years ago, I was very open about it because I was just like help. All it was help. And then when I got out of there and I got tools, new tools to work with. Who thought of that, right? I didn't even. I wasn't even sure I would come out of there with a solution, but I just wanted to give it one last shot before I decided my outcome. And then after that, I opened up to people, and people who they blew my mind. Who people who said, "Oh yeah, I've checked myself in too," and it's just like to open up the conversation when no one really brings it up. No one goes, "Hi, my name's Tony, and I checked myself into the hospital for suicidal ideation 14 years ago. How are you?" You don't. It's not something you just. It's not something that comes up in like, "Hey, how are you?" "Well, I'm all right." They don't want to know the rest of it. So the but when we talk about it, when we open it up, when you open up as much as you have, that is when progress happens on this. And I don't I and we'll talk about this with how did you find your way to let go of the shame that the family dynamic had on you. I mean, because that family dynamic doesn't go away, even when the family is gone and even or distant or far away, whatever happens, we have that ingrained in our DNA. What do you think it was that finally kind of released the shame, or was it little tidbits of things happening where it was boiling up and you're like, I need to write this story. What was the story of that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I feel like there's a couple questions in there
There's
that
like nine, so just pick one or two, you're fine.
Well, I had tried to write it before, I think I always wanted to tell my mom's story. I felt like she deserved to have her story told. Because I could tell the story that was getting told about her was, I was too young to understand when it happened. I was six, but I didn't think I loved her. I did not think she was a bad person. And then I began to, I was immediately sent back to school the next day and told not to talk about it.
So
And
did
that
they
was my
tell
family.
did they tell you exactly what happened, or did they give you like a little bit of a lie, or like, 'cause what does a
I try to
six-year-old
remember.
understand at that point? 'Cause I know when my mom's mom killed herself, my mom was 13, and they lied about it and said it was a heart attack, and she didn't know until later. So
I think, as far as I remember, that I was told that she died.
yeah.
And then I went back to school. I don't remember when I first heard the word suicide, but I went back to school and then I tried to capture this in the book. There was an obituary, it just had that she died. And then there was an obituary that said exactly how she died by suicide. And then my sister got teased by other children in school who somehow heard it from their parents. And I remember her coming home crying. And then I think more of the story came out. I think my dad sat us down and had to tell us the whole thing because
Yeah.
we were going to hear it one way or another. That I don't remember how soon it was, but it was in bits and pieces like that, which I think is why it also took so long to piece together. And then at first I tried to write about it as fiction. And I don't think I could ever make it work because
Okay.
I think I was still pretending to myself that this didn't really happen.
Okay, okay.
And I think I carried that for a long way. I think through the writing process was still a process of me because I didn't go through years of therapy. I really used writing. I never told friends, almost never. And when I did, it's like people didn't know this about me, pretty much, And when I did those conversations, I never felt like they went very well, I couldn't control the conversation, and I could tell people had feelings. And then if I would say, "Look, it's not useful for you to look down on me," and they would be like, "No, I'm not doing that," and they couldn't sort of see what they were doing that wasn't helpful, that made it hard for me to, being myself and fully open. And only in a couple places was I able to be open. Just carried a lot of secrecy and shame about it, I think because of how that message first went in, which I think of that my family was really trying to protect me. They weren't trying to do a cool thing. But I remember being in graduate school and first trying to write this story as fiction. Because there wasn't such a movement to write nonfiction, unless it was like a factual story, like your biography or the story of trains were invented or something. There wasn't creative nonfiction so much yet, and there definitely wasn't memoir. And I think that's also something that's changed that's allowed me to write this story that I've been lucky enough to live long enough to this point where the world has changed and it's changing. And I think women used to get told more that if your writing was too autobiographical, that was bad. I think because women, and not just women, but because I'm conscious of speaking to you as a man who has written, had the bravery to write personally and it's smarts to use comedy in writing about in fiction. But
And comedy and tragedy are so close when you could, and I come from a, I'm well, when I say comedy and tragedy, I feel like we're in such a human condition that we can either cry or laugh, like constantly. You can cry or you can laugh. And I love finding the way where it delights me to no end if I can find the angle where people walk away with seeing it in two different ways. Where people go, oh my God, that was so, that was so hard to read. And people go, "That, oh my God, I was laughing on that one scene." And they sit and they're talking about the exact same scene, and I'm just like, "I did my job." You know, it's that I have this insane desire to like make those things kind of blur a little bit. And I don't,
Wow.
it doesn't happen often, but when it happens, that's when I'm like, okay, I did that. I found the piece of the puzzle that needed to be solved, and it worked. So,
Wow.
yeah.
Well, I admire you then. I don't, that's a great skill, which I cannot claim to have, but
Well, it's, yeah.
I love that.
When you were writing it as fiction, did it seem like it was an important part of the process in order to get to the memoir, to have those fiction pages?
Maybe it was like
Yeah.
a long time ago. And then I think I write about this in the book too, that I had at different points gotten a hold of letters that were my mom's.
Yeah.
And in a class on, trying to remember what it was in graduate school, maybe it was directly on memoir, I tried to use those letters and I got heavily criticized by the teacher. For some reason, it struck a chord the wrong way. And she went ballistic on me teaching as the teacher when I presented the work and was upset mostly that it went on too long. And I think, as hard as that was to hear, years later, it was useful because I noticed that when I wrote using those documents that I didn't save the originals of, but I had this typed transcript of what I had tried to write along with her notes that fortunately I couldn't read anymore, but I did cut heavily, to sound so that it was more manageable for the reader, I think. But yeah, it was probably part of the process to write fiction first, and then I was ready. Really, what happened was the pandemic came, and a lot other things that I was doing stopped and shut down, and I had this time and this quiet, and the world got really quiet, and I could focus it on myself and concentrate. And first, I tried to write. The first thing I tried to write was a novel, based on like one of the happiest times in my life. That was like the balance. And then I knew it wasn't quite done, and I put it aside, like cook it on the back burner. And I went and I was like, okay, I'm ready to write my mom's story now. Because I really had this feeling, what I want to start living my life as if this could be my last day. What do I really want to be doing? What is most important for me to get done? What have I not faced? And I sat down and I made myself write it, and it wasn't easy, but I really tried to be very disciplined about clearing out all distractions and listen to the voice in my head. And then, like, if I can do that long enough, I would take off the every weekend and just have a regular schedule as if it was a paid job. Not like 8 hours a day, but maybe actually the meat of it, like work for 2 or 3, maybe 4 hours a day. And everything else I had to do, like do some things in the morning and not let everything interrupt and chunk everything else in the afternoon. Monday and Tuesday might be crappy days. Wednesday, I might get a really good day because I like worked to that state and then would taper off. And the characters, I mean, they were real people, but think of them as characters, just started to talk in my head and tell the story for me and help me. And even dreams, And I didn't work with outlines or a preconception of where I was going, or I just tried to work through it. And that's, I think, what came to me in the end about the releasing the shame. I always felt like there's so many things that I could have still been trying to release, but it came to me kind of intuitively. Okay, we'll call it shame. Call it shame, And it's a story I'm telling. I definitely don't feel I've actually fully done that or something, but I do feel like I'm in a different place from having written that book. And then I spent like maybe a year revising it. And then I spent a year maybe trying to get it published, and it was not easy
Right.
because nobody wants to publish this book. Nobody wants to talk about it. It's not going to
Yeah.
make any money.
Right. And
They just
so
shrug and hang
how
up.
did you finally land a publisher?
Just kept trying places,
Yeah.
looking who's taking what, and send it out maybe, 5 places every week, every month or so, and just keep
Yeah.
at it. As much as I had time, I'd send it out. So much to the point where I would track it, but I wasn't paying attention to the no's coming back. I
Yeah.
just focused, send it out, send it out, send it out.
This
And then
that's a hard part.
finally found its home. Yeah.
Yeah, it's such a hard part of the gig because it's like, and especially I think now is also a hard part of the gig for you because what we've worked on for so long kind of becomes it becomes this thing, and then all of a sudden it's like not ours anymore. It's in the world. It's theirs. I don't know if you have that feeling where you're just like, oof. When my first novel came out, it was really vulnerable, and I was like, oh my God, this is it. Like, people are gonna like trash this, or they're gonna enjoy whatever's gonna happen, but I have zero control over any of this. And that was my story that I had control over for 3 or 4 years. And it's just like, what do you do now when you don't have control? And I'm learning, as I, hope my next novel comes out at some point as I'm querying right now, but I kind of know the game of what you're going through. I've been there, and now I know the game of, oh yeah, it's not going to feel great. There's not going to be any parades down Main Street. It's just, it's like this great silence that happens. You do some promotion, you do this here and there, and you get excited, and then all of a sudden, like, the promotion dies after 3 months, and it's just like, oh. But I think when you write something this heartfelt, this has legs, and it lasts, and people keep finding it and finding it and finding it, and that's the glory of, I mean, I've the joy that I've had with my novel that came out. People still contact me and are just like, you told my story. I didn't think anybody had my story. And I'm just like, okay, I did my job. And I'm like, oh, wait a second. No, I could have written it as a screenplay with Kevin Hart in it and probably have a huge house right now in the Hollywood Hills. Then I would have done better financially. But, sometimes we got to do the hard part, which is write the truth and write the essence of the truth and let it be,
Say the name of your novel for me again, please.
It's called Confessions of a Teenage Jesus Jerk.
Oh,
Yeah.
well, I'm going to go look for it.
Yeah, I could tell
And
you. I could tell you more about it after we're done
but
talking about you.
right. But
Go ahead.
that's part of my thank you back for doing this, because you are doing an amazing thing, this podcast. And I do feel like it's part of what's interesting and good about, I mean, my attitude about suicide is that, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about it, but that it's a good thing to be alive. Like, it's a
Yes.
really good thing to be alive. And I
Yeah.
am kind of trying to fully engage with my love affair with life, constantly to counter what was like for my mom. And part of my story is that her father died by suicide also, and that was partly what was hidden and confusing, and I just could never talk about it. It was weird enough that my mom did, but then her father did too, and it seemed to always point the finger that I was next in line.
Yeah.
So because I was the child who looked the most like my mom, that they I think they worried about me, and I picked up on that.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, I forget where I was going with that
You
because I have
don't
a
need to
lot of
remember anything.
stories there. Yeah.
How old was your mom when her father killed himself?
Nine.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I was six, and she didn't use the same, she didn't die in the same way, but she repeated the pattern a lot. Like it was Sunday late afternoon, like Sunday evening when you have to face the next week,
Yeah.
you know? And her father had been exactly the same way. And I have noticed that Sunday afternoons are often like a time that I still feel kind of melancholy.
Yeah.
It carries that for me. So, but the writing the book is part of undoing the legacy. And the thing that I found too, like, I feel like the timing worked because as soon as it was accepted by Apprentice House Press, which is the university press of the University of Loyola in Maryland, and it's the only completely student-run press in the country. And so getting accepted there was really interesting. I think it's like those young adults are the ones who read the manuscript and loved it and didn't think, oh, this is too heavy, or we can't sell this.
Right.
And they know about there being this movement now of people wanting to hear about intergenerational family trauma, they call it.
Yes,
How do
yes.
we undo intergenerational family trauma? I never even heard of it before, and I didn't know that I was part of that movement.
Yeah.
You know, that's what I was trying to get at before, too, like that I didn't know that I was part of this movement of women telling their stories of trauma, of like revealing all the hard things that are going on underground about the current way that we all are organized to live in the world, like the
Yeah.
hidden reality that it's not so great for everybody, and that, that 2,000 people a day feel a day worldwide feel bad enough about their life that they have to decide to end it.
Yeah.
And it's this huge number, you know, that that's how much everybody is not just happy and doing fine. So that we don't talk about, like, that's where the statistics help give us a glimpse of reality. So I'm just in the water swimming. Like,
Yeah.
I'm the writer, the artist who's the conduit. I think of it like when the faucet is turned on, the message comes through me. It's not all mine. I just, as honestly as I can, report the truth and get my story out there. And it's part of the uncovering of the not talking about suicide.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting to be part of the conversation. Like, I wanted to put the book out there, no matter how vulnerable or scary it feels to me. I feel lucky to be able to do it. And I just wanted to join the conversation and help shape it, you know, and tell the story, like reclaim my mom's story that she was not a bad person. She was not a monster. And it's been really exciting too, because I just like had no idea. Okay. Like I told myself the whole time I'm writing the book, I'm just writing this for myself. I don't have to write it for anybody else.
Yes. Those, and that's why, that's when great things happen when we write for ourselves. Yeah.
And many other things that I had to tell myself. Like, I had a list of, I didn't have a good title for it. I had a list of working titles. And one of them was always like, this book totally sucks. And I would just let it be bad. Just
Yes.
do
Oh my God. Bless your
it.
heart. I tell my students all the time, I'm like, please, I just finished a work, a novel writing workshop, and I was getting mad at my students. I'm like, this does not suck enough. What are you doing? I was getting mad. I'm like, next week, I want just the worst writing you can give me. If you give me any good writing, you're failed. And so they sent me, and they were just so like depressed that they had to send me their worst writing. And I'm like, you guys. Your characters are juicy now. They're like popping off. Give yourself the permission to be messy, because characters are messy and we're messy in life. So when we go ahead and get messy, that's when the truth comes out. And it's so much fun to see the students' eyes just kind of go, when you see them get it, and they're like, oh, I'm like, yeah, stop trying to be good. Stop that. That's for rewrites. It's not for now. It's like, go to it. Yeah, yeah. I love your working title. What was it? This book sucks anyway.
Right. This really sucks. Or
this book really sucks. Chapter 4.
Let it.
Yes. Oh my God. It's the best place to be. It's the only place to be as a writer, because I feel like we have to be fools. We really got to embrace the fool, and the fool in ourselves, and be open. And I always think of like Lucille Ball, who's just like one of the greatest clowns of all time, and she's like the fool, but she's a powerful force. And I love watching Lucy reruns. It's just the genius in her, and she's just playing the fool. And when we embrace that fool, that's when great things happen.
Yeah. When you do something that you couldn't have done on purpose and you surprise yourself and the writing comes to life.
Yeah.
And I forget what I was going to say about it, but you know, I set the goal. I tried to say in the beginning, like, why am I writing this book? Mm-hmm. I tried to set it for myself too, so I wouldn't lose my way. Like, where am I trying to get to?
Okay.
And one of the things was like, I want to bring my mom back in some way. Want to make her come to life. And then recently I was lucky enough to get a review of my book. And that's when it's kind of exciting to hear that it means anything to anybody else, you know, because it was such an internal process. And the reviewer, who was nameless on this site, I don't even know who it was, I feel like did me the great honor of like showing back to me what the book meant to them, describing it and what it did. And it just feels like, wow, that's cool. I didn't know that I did that. And one of the things they said was they used my mother's full name in it. And this makes me cry too, because that is one of the only times I can remember seeing my mom's full name, which gives respect to the person out in the world, outside the documents that I have of hers and the world of her that I created in my book. So now she stepped out of the book again, and she is out there in the world. Not like she came back to life, but her story and the story of her being a human being, not just somebody who did people wanted to, you know, banish and make never come back again because of this horrible thing that she did. So that's what I think is cool. That's where it becomes not my story anymore.
Yeah.
And people will take it and bring their own meaning to it and have it live on, and where it's part of the conversation of what's changing about suicide. And there was like a couple of things I wanted to say about that, because I don't, since I wrote the book and during it, I am kind of not what I want to do. It makes me feel a little sick, but I feel like I have to do it, is read a little bit about the history of suicide, and it helps explain what happened, you know, and that, sorry, I have to look at notes about this, but that suicide is still currently a crime in many countries in the world.
Oh, like interesting. Yeah. Crime. Yeah.
And it's, but it's only recently being changed, you know, and that it's that we're in the middle of that change happening. And that I didn't grow up Catholic. I grew up Protestant, but not practicing, just like culturally Protestant, but not really deeply religiously Protestant. But I took in all the messages and the values and the moral judgments that were in the world, you know, when I was a child. And like Ireland only fully decriminalized suicide in 1993.
Wow.
That's really recent. And the church the Catholic Church only stopped treating suicide as an unforgivable mortal sin in 1992.
Wow.
And another one that I think, okay, this is good. I don't know if I can find it. About when people were allowed, when the church said people were allowed to be buried in cemeteries, I think it was only like 1982. Before that, people were not allowed, who were suicides, were not allowed to be buried in the cemetery. So, we just took in all these messages about that. Even after laws or rules were changed, people still carry those feelings and it gets communicated verbally or directly or indirectly, And so,
Yeah, there's a reason. The reason I, because I grew up in a strict religion where I couldn't really read outside materials. I had to read the Watchtower literature of the Jehovah's Witnesses. Like that was the, and so and then they excommunicate you. One of my friends got excommunicated, and he killed himself. And this is a very common problem in the Jehovah's Witnesses where they don't, now looking back, it's just like, oh wow, they just deny it though. They're just like, oh, he went to Satan's world. That's what happens when you leave the Jehovah's Witnesses. And that's exactly what they said to me when I was asking for help from the elders, and they're just like, he's already dead to Jehovah, so there's no reason to like grieve him. And that in my head, I was just like, in my head, I was clinging on to something, to my faith that I truly believed 100%. And at the same time, I knew that was wrong. I was like, okay. And I just stopped going to the Kingdom Hall for a while and just went to the library every night. And I read Tony Robbins and I read Wayne Dyer. And I just sat there and read those guys. And that's what kind of got me into the library to process my grief, and then also go, how do I not? Because I was having ideation at that time, and that's just like, and my uncle had just killed himself about 2 years earlier, and it was just like swirling around. I'm like, this is just too much. This is too much. I need to focus on reading psychology books, and that kind of turned into finding the poetry section, and then poetry was like started to speak to me, and then I was like, well, what about these novel things that I couldn't really read too much in high school? Because I was in my 20s at the time, and then I started reading like novels, and then that just blew open all the doors. I didn't leave the Jehovah's Witnesses for quite a while, but it was the crack that I was getting a different conversation other than what was I was being brainwashed in. And that's why I am of the church of storytelling, and especially novels, and just and ev every book is just like sacred to me because it's part of the mythology, and it these books helped me get out of a very dark place, and I know your book will help other people get out of a very dark place. It's just beautiful that when we have our books out there, it's like we added to the conversation. We're on the shelf. It's there. It's there for the taking.
That's
Please
right.
take it.
Right. Well, that's an amazing story. Thank you.
It's
Yeah, and
this is where, and I'm still working through this, but the process of grief, and then the it's not like, oh, that it's not like, oh, that's great that happened. It's no, that's terrible that happened, but this is the path that it moved me toward, and I'm forever grateful that I moved toward that path. That path saved me on so many levels and continues to save me to this day. If I'm feeling down, I have classic books ready to go to just sit there and span across time and read some Victor Hugo and be in France in the 1700s for a little bit and really engage with it and realize that, I mean, we are alone in some ways, in our own points of view of life, but in the end, we're not alone. And when we have, classic books or books of the past or contemporary books, we're connecting beyond like space and time when we read that stuff. And it's just like, oh, everybody has the same problems. Nothing changes. It's just it's beautiful. It's just like, okay, all right, I got it.
Yeah, well said.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I don't know what else to say. You're a good storyteller, and
Oh, well, shucks,
I know
thanks.
you're an amazing teacher too, I can tell. And also, it just makes sense why you're doing this podcast, which I
Yes.
think what I was trying to say before is why the podcasts are so interesting, and it's part of what's changing in the world is that people are talking to each other, in this constantly and
Yes.
communicating ideas about what's important to each of us in a way that did not used to be possible. I know what I was thinking, that the language of suicide is changing. Like I think I had was working on the first draft and I went to a yoga retreat and I was telling somebody I met and became friends with about the book that I was writing, and she and I had so much in common. And one thing she told me was, and I hadn't known it, I had written a whole almost first draft, I think. And she was like, people have stopped saying killed themselves. The
I
current
know.
language is died by suicide. And when
Oh,
I try to take
okay.
that in, I realize I love that. That helps me so much lift some of the shame and stigma off
Wow,
of my
yeah.
mother. But
Yeah.
having grown up with that saying, as you probably did too, it's still what rolls most easily off my tongue because I said it for decades of my
Yeah.
life, But when I changed that and I shifted to died by suicide, it does help shift some of the blame off the person.
Yes.
Because that's the thing that the 2,000 people a day globally dying by suicide gets at the picture of is like, this is more than about the individual's problems. Even though we each do have our individual problems, but the fact that it's such a huge thing is it's like a part of the system that puts people in this situation and there's not help. And so
Yeah.
it's not it's more than the individual. And so I always think that suicide is not good. Like, I'm not promoting suicide, but people are good. And people always did the very, each person always does the very best that they can,
Yeah.
no matter what it looks like. Like, it could look like the most horrible solution, the way that my mom died.
Yeah.
But still, I decide, like, each person always fully has the right, and the ability to choose your point of view, like in writing, you get
Oh,
to
yeah.
pick where
Yeah.
you're telling the story from. And then the other part of it is like so the person is good, no matter what they do or did.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean like that terrible things don't happen and exist, but the person inside underneath that is always completely good. And so I choose to look back and see what my mother did, is the best possible thing that she could come up with at that time,
Yeah.
and to forgive her,
That's
And
wow. That's see now that's that that is the superpower, the forgiveness, which I still feel like I'm working on so many levels. But
yeah, I
when
can't
we
honestly say that I do it, but I can say that
yeah.
I choose to try to.
Yes.
Like,
And
I
I do
choose my point of
too.
view. Yeah.
Yeah, where there's I guess I get to the point where I have empathy and I understand why certain things like went down in a bad way, and then and then I get disappointed that there was so many openings for it for things to be in a different direction. And I'm still working on it. I'm still working on the forgiveness. I'm still working on not having resentment. And then I just realized this kind of recently that resentment and anger are like two different things. Like it's okay to be angry. It's okay to be angry at it. And then, but the resentment will eat us up. So with the anger's kind of like It's like a what? Yeah, here I am, and now what are you going to do about it? It's almost like tapping you on the shoulder, going, "You got some decisions to make. How are you going to view life and view your life and view the trajectory and view the human existence and the human condition? How are you going to view that with this anger?" And you can go, there's ways to go, and none of them are comfortable. And just like when you were talking earlier about about it being scary writing the story and getting the story out there, I understand that because I have major fears. I used to have major phobias too, and I still have phobias where I couldn't get on an airplane for 20 years. And now I'm back on airplanes, and I've been working a lot on that. And there was even one time where I was ready to tell him to go back to the gate. I'm gonna lose it. And I'll tell you exactly what happened in my mind as I was sitting there, and I was just like profusely sweating. I'm like, I'm out, get me off, this is it. And it's like taxiing, and I just did my breathing because I was having a massive panic attack. And then so I did my breathing, and then I started to really have those thoughts. I was like, oh, this isn't gonna get better. Like I'm gonna, I just felt so out of control. And then I came to the point where the breathing is so important. And I came to the point where I had a rational thought. And I said to myself, I said, Tony, what's more scarier, being on the other side of that door and back at the gate and watching this plane take off, or being inside the plane and having the plane take off? And I was like, okay, it's 1% scarier to be on the other side of that door watching this plane take off and feeling like I failed. So even though both of them are like at 99% right now of fear, that one's gonna suck more. So let's just stay on this plane. Then you stay on the plane, and your body can't keep up with that type of tension. It's like, okay, we're done. So like, I don't know if you've ever had panic attacks, but like sometimes after a panic attack, you're just sitting there going, "Whoo, hey!" It's almost like you got drunk because your body's just going, "We can only do that for about 5 minutes." That's for you to run away from the tiger that's tearing after you in the wild. That's not for you in this, situation of trying to just fly to another country or whatever.
Well, what I have panic attack about is being on podcasts, apparently,
Oh, okay.
and like doing a public reading, which I have agreed to do one in 2 weeks.
Yes.
I don't know. There's so many things that I could say about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has gotten less scary when
Yeah.
I face it down, you know? Like the one yesterday, like I was telling you, it didn't go so well, you know? But already, this is much easier and much better.
Oh,
And
this po
it's,
they're doing this podcast.
yeah, and
Because I
it's,
think it's a better podcast. I don't know where you were yesterday, but I feel like this is the better one.
it absolutely is. You are really good at what you do.
Oh, shucks. Thanks. Not that I was milking for that
But why not take it? I forget what I was going to say about it.
No,
Oh,
we were
so
talking about you have.
one person who helped me the most with getting ready was the woman I went to a couple weeks ago to cut my hair. And she's a Russian immigrant, and she just, was working her butt off all the time. And we talk. I've known her for 15 years, and I go in and she's excited about my book. I've been telling her about it. She asked me how it's doing. We always talk about how our dogs are doing and our children. And I ask her how's she doing? And she's telling me this story of a personal thing. I won't reveal her story here. That's hers to tell, but of something she has to do coming up that she's really scared. It's not going to go well. And I'm trying to reassure her this way, you can deep breathing and step outside, and that's not doing it. Finally, I just intuitively come up with, because she's telling me, well, she doesn't even speak, perfect, English traditionally, but that doesn't stop her, She has her own business. She does this as a woman. She's doing great, And she says, maybe doing these podcasts won't be so bad, Hillary. And that tone of voice is like, that's what put me over the hump. And then I told her, well, what I could find to say helpful to her was, well, when you're in that hard place, Tanya, and you feel you're about to kill person X at your son's baby shower, just why don't we change places? I'll go to the baby shower for you, and you go on the podcast for me. She collapses hysterically laughing. Like, that is the perfect solution for her. I don't know why that's a good story to tell, but it's something
Well, it's
else.
a
You never
great.
know what's going to help, how we can help each other with this that we carry, that we don't have to face alone, And that's why the doing the podcast is so fun and interesting, because you're just out there because you love this thing, talking and connecting to people across all kinds of books and all kinds of people, It's a great thing,
And
I
that's the
think.
thing, just like talking about it. It's just like then we can almost kind of carry each other's burdens. Like you actually put the scenario of carrying her burden and she can carry your burden. And the beauty of that and the comedy of that is just hilarious. And then all of a sudden it lightens both of you. And that's the beauty of it, of that. What you did was lighten both of you, because when we put it's I was even talking to another writer. It's just like we're so hard on ourselves. Like we're great on our students. We're telling our students, or when I have like clients where I'm doing development editing for them and stuff, and it's just like, and I'm like, oh, this is so great, and you nailed this. Just add this, and we need to work on this character. And I was doing a memoir development, and I always refer to everyone's characters, like you said. So if I was working with you, I would be the character of Hillary. We're working on the character of Hillary right now. It's always character. And it's because that's what it is. What we're trying to craft memoirs. So when you craft a memoir, you have to have these arcs, and you have to have these, where these things go. So it's
Well, interestingly, I never studied that. Didn't think about it. If I had done that ahead of time, I don't know for this story if I would have been able to get it told, because I don't know, it was already such a hard story to tell, and I had
Yeah.
tried over the years, so I had a little, laid down a little whatever groundwork of discouragement, and am I going to be able to do this? So I just had to close my eyes and work intuitively. No, maybe you're talking about in the review process, you bring those things in,
Oh
but
yes, I'm looking at manuscripts that are finished, and I'm going, this is how we're going to punch this up, and
But
yeah.
one little mantra that I developed my list of six, half a dozen or a dozen things that I would look at when I needed help to get started. I'm talking like generating the first draft still. And one of them was, we talked about let it be bad, let it suck, just write it for myself. Get one tiny bit done each day. It doesn't mean you won't get more done, but when you do, then you can still look back and feel good about it instead of, I didn't get anything done. It doesn't matter how small it is, just get one, start with that. And I say these things because maybe they'll be helpful to other people who are trying to write these kind of stories. But the other one I love that I came up with by chance was from somebody who wrote an article who was a wedding planner. And I'm sorry, I don't remember their name, so I can't credit them for their idea, but it was really helpful to me. And she said, like, women or whoever get so uptight about picking out the dress. And so her mantra about the dress is just keep the energy around the dress light. And so I took that and borrowed it for this writing project. And it was just always like, if I'm feeling stuck, just remember, keep the energy around the project light. And then it was like a lifting, and I could have idea and get started. I think because the environment I grew up in was like, not literary people, but like college educated, middle class, and we're supposed to do something really important, and it's got to be good, and it's, so like figure out how to let go of that isn't easy. It's like it's attached all over.
And I think it's a, yeah, I think it's a society thing in general too. I mean, collectively, that's why people don't write books, because they can't bring themselves to get to that point, because they just, they have a hard time being vulnerable on the page and also having writing terribly. And that is like the two main things you got to do to be a writer. You have to be vulnerable and you have to write terrible. Because what you got to have fun and rewrites. You can't have any fun in rewrites if you write good. Don't, ugh.
All
Yeah.
set.
I get why I keep this question keeps pinging in my head, and I'm like, oh, keep re remembering, and I keep forgetting, and now I finally remember it. Has any of your family read the book? Are they accepting of the book? Is there any what's that relationship like?
Well, it's touchy.
Yeah.
My current family, either they don't read, they don't like to read, or they
Okay.
say they'll read it and they
Right.
want, they intend to read it.
Yeah.
One person, I won't identify them, did finally read it, and I had to really encourage them. And then they love it, which is
Oh,
so
that's good.
reassuring, because their opinion means everything to me, you know.
Yeah.
Then a lot of my family members are dead, so that gives me some leeway in better and for better and worse, you know.
Yeah.
I can't go back and get any more
Yeah.
information from them, and I didn't deliberately wait. It just took me that long, you know.
Yeah.
And then some people I'm not in a current relationship with, and I, even though you are supposed to check, I have not, and I've just done my best to change everybody's names and
Yeah.
put the little note in the beginning that I'm not trying to tell the be all end all
Right.
story, own everyone's story. This is just my best take on how it was for me.
Thank you for your courage, because it takes a lot. Her name is Hillary Plattner. Her book is called The Mama Puzzle, a memoir. Hillary, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR-LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT-LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.